Good morning. Today I'd like to talk about an era of the White Sox history that pains me very much. I grew up on the North Side as a White Sox fan, surrounded by Cub fans. For my entire life, I've lived and died with the White Sox, and mostly died, by the way. So it pains me to talk about a low point in Chicago baseball history, Chicago White Sox history. Now, the title of this talk is The Ultimate Tear Down and Rebuild. The themes of this talk are: in the aftermath of the Black Sox scandal, the Chicago White Sox faced a teardown that was unique in baseball history. A teardown of a championship team, but not by the club's own volition. It was caused by incidents outside the club's control. Imagine a Major League Baseball team where half of its players die in a plane crash. That's essentially what the White Sox faced in 1921. That's not advancing here. Involved here. I was advancing before. Yeah, that's what I did, yeah.
There you go. So yeah, just keep it. Oh, you gotta scroll down. That's what happened. You can just click back over here.
There we go. Well, what is a teardown? The terms teardown and rebuild have been popularized in recent years, most notably by the Houston Astros, who around 2010 tore down their existing team, traded their best players for some young talent. They finished in the cellar for a couple years, but within 5 years they were a competitive team again. I'm going to be analyzing the White Sox rebuild in these circumstances, and of course I'm going to be using WAR and WA, wins above replacement and wins above average. Hopefully most of you are familiar with those statistics. I want to emphasize that the Sox teardown was an involuntary teardown, perhaps the only one in modern baseball history. Unlike the present day, when a last place team can get a higher standing in the amateur draft, they can improve their team that way. There was no amateur draft in the 1920s. Today there's also free agency and international signings. This all should make rebuilding a team easier today. But the Sox didn't have those advantages in the 1920s. The one advantage the Sox had in the 1920s compared to today was that there was essentially a sort of free agent market for minor league talent, where teams could, like the Philadelphia A's did, purchase a lefty Grove from Baltimore and instantly improve themselves. With that as the context, we can view the 1920s White Sox, and especially the 1922 season and subsequent years, as the ultimate teardown and rebuild. It's a unique rebuild because so much was lost and so little was gained because of the teardown. From the 1920 season, where the Sox finished 96-58, second place, and arguably they threw games in 1920 as well, but that's another story. The club lost 7 suspended players, including 4 starting field players and 2 starting pitchers, and gained no compensation for that loss. Unlike the 1914 Philadelphia A's or the modern Astros, the Sox couldn't even plan who they were letting go in the rebuild. It was done for them. So this can be considered, I think, the ultimate teardown. What I'm going to analyze today is how well or how poorly the White Sox and Charlie Comiskey managed that rebuild. Now, I'm not going to compare the White Sox to rebuild to other teams that tore down in the 1800s. Cleveland Spiders of 1898-99. Of course, we know that they had a dual ownership and a lot of other hijinks that were happening in the 1800s. I'm not going to talk about that because it's not really a comparison. But perhaps the most famous and most relevant comparison to the White Sox in the 1920s was the Philadelphia Athletics of 1914-15. As you probably know, the Athletics had won the pennant in 1914. Looked like they had a dynasty. They'd won the pennant three of the last 4 years. But a cash-strapped Connie Mack realized he couldn't keep his players together. Couldn't keep the team together. So he let them go. He let go four Hall of Famers. Eddie Collins, Chief Bender, Plank, Home Run Baker. And what happened? Well, Mack tried to do a rebuild. The A's finished in last place for 9 consecutive years after that. They did not achieve a winning record until 1925. And at least Mack got something for Eddie Collins, $50,000, by the way. The White Sox got nothing for the loss that they had. Did the Sox save any money by losing these players? Well, not really. The yearly salaries combined of the 7 that were suspended after the 1920 season, $46,600. Well, as we'll see, the Sox rebuild did not suffer from the lack of money. The Sox had been a very profitable franchise all during the 1910s. They were annually finishing at or near the top of league attendance. And as we'll see, Comiskey paid large sums of money to acquire talent. He will pay $100,000, a then record amount, just to get a third baseman from the Pacific Coast League. Well, he can. The myth that Comiskey was some sort of tightwad, well, hopefully you don't believe that myth anymore, but some do. I'm not only saying that he spent the money wisely, but he did spend the money. Of course, spending but not wisely, I mean, that can be applied to the 2023 White Sox as well. Especially if you saw last night's doubleheader. Well, just a brief summary of the rebuild. For 1921, the Sox brought up some young players they had options on, such as outfielders Big Falk and Johnny Mostel, and basically purchased the Salt Lake City team's infield. First baseman Earl Shealy, shortstop Ernie Johnson, third baseman Eddie Mulligan. Now, there was a fall off in the field with these young players. I mean, you can't replace stars with rookies and unknowns that easily. And they certainly weren't able in 1921 to replace starting pitchers Eddie Seacott and Lefty Williams. Of the minor league pitchers brought into camp in 1921, one newspaper acidly remarked, quote, "Know any of them? Neither do we." However, 1922 showed improvement to .500 record. That was due to the new field players maturing, playing a little better, almost 6 more WAR from essentially the same lineup, plus a marked improvement in the pitching. And a lot of that was due to the fact that Red Faber had a Steve Carlton type year, 1970, 25-14 with a 2.48 earned run average. He carried the team basically in the team pitching in 1922. Now, new starters Dixie Leverett, Ted Blankenship, and Charlie Robertson replaced the gaggle of 1921 unknown pitchers, who were all, of course, that Comiskey could find that year. However, the Sox lost World Series hero Dickie Kerr to a contract dispute. 1923 saw the White Sox purchase for a then-record $100,000 the star third baseman of the Pacific Coast League, Willie Cam. Cam went on to have a solid, though not spectacular, White Sox career, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. The field team improved by 1 WAR, but the pitchers regressed a little. As Red Faber started to show signs of age and hard work, But 1923 also saw the debut, just a cup of coffee, of Hall of Famer Ted Williams, Ted Lyons, excuse me. The pitching staff regressed further in 1924. Lyons, Ted Blankenship, Sloppy Thurston, great nickname for a pitcher. They showed promise, but Faber aged further, and none of the other pitchers did much. As we'll see, the poor defense contributed to the downfall in 1924. But 1925 saw the first fruits of the rebuild. The Sox posted their first winning record since 1920. The field players remained remarkably healthy, and Lyons emerged as a pitching star. The fielding improved dramatically, too. The club improved more in 1926. Young outfielder Johnny Mosco finished second in the MVP voting that year. Outfielder Ben Falk hit a solid 327. The fielding improved more, and the Sox acquired in Tommy Thomas, a star from the Baltimore Orioles. He'd been Lefty Groves' teammate on the team. Great pitcher, not well known by Major League experts. The good young starters led at least one newspaper expert to predict that the Sox would be pennant contenders that year. Now, one note of worry was that the longtime stars catcher Ray Schalk and second baseman Eddie Collins were starting to show their age. 1927 and 1928 marked a letdown, not in the pitching staff so much as in the field team. In 1927, Collins left for Philadelphia. Schalk played only 16 games. First baseman Earl Shealy was benched. The team was not able to find suitable replacements. Star outfielder Johnny Mosco committed suicide, or attempted to commit to suicide, during spring training. Fortunately, he recovered. The reasons, by the way, are still sort of obscure. We don't know exactly why he did that. Arguably, he was unlucky in love and thought that was worth committing suicide for. He recovered, but he was never the same player. And 1928 saw the decline go even further. The Sox simply didn't replace these 25, 26 players with anybody remotely comparable. Schalk retired to become manager, and halfway through the season, he was so disgusted by the team, he retired. He quit as manager. Interestingly, throughout all this rebuild, the Sox actually continued to draw very well. They were never first in attendance, but even when the team was bad, they were above average in league attendance. And since in those days, team revenue was mostly ticket revenue, the Sox had enough revenue, enough of a revenue stream, to remain competitive. This is the one loss record for the early 1920s here. Notice that I've highlighted 1921. Basically, uncertainty surrounded the 1921 season. Sox management couldn't know if the trial of the Black Sox players would even occur that year, given all the legal maneuvering and all the other things that were going on. The Sox couldn't know the verdict of the Black Sox trial. They couldn't know if the commissioner would ban the Black Sox if they were found guilty or if they were found not guilty. They couldn't know that the players, if banned, might be reinstated somehow, or at a minimum, would sue to get their back pay. Going into the 1921 season, Charlie Comiskey was hamstrung. But once the trial was over in August of 1921, and the Black Sox were banned for life, Comiskey had more certainty. Comiskey could then start the rebuild in earnest. And here's the one loss record in visual chart for, in visual graph form here. Notice the incredible decline from 20 to 21. I'm going to show you runs scored versus runs given up, 22 to 26, and other war stuff. But basically, Shealy and Johnson replaced Gamble and Risberg quite adequately. Willie Cam replaced Buck Weaver. Lyons and Thomas replaced Seacott and Williams. And by 1922, within a year of this 21 uncertainty, they basically replaced the wins above average of the Black Sox pitchers and the Black Sox infielders. Here's a couple of the players here illustrating what I was talking about here. One of the things I discovered in my research was that Swede Risberg and Chick Gamble weren't that good of players. I won't make any comparison to current White Sox, but their replacements, and these were, the Johnson and Sheely are basically scrap heap replacements. They were just as good as the people they were replacing. And Cam actually was better than Buck Weaver. The White Sox of 1919-20 simply weren't as good as some of the legends have it. The problem was more the outfield. You have Joe Jackson. You have Happy Felch. Those are people that really can't be replaced that easily. And the White Sox were not able to replace them until 1925 or 1926. And as we'll see, Mostel committed suicide, and Bib Falk got into a contract dispute and left the team. Now, if you're into, again, war and wah, here's the statistics for those years. Note that the White Sox of 1926 in their war and wah are pretty close to what they had in 1919 and 1920. And here's a visual of what I was just showing you. Again, by 1926, team war approached that of 1920. Just looking at the field team, not the pitchers, again, you can see the great drop-off in 1921, but I got the arrow to highlight that 1925-26, the field team war is again pretty close to what you saw in 1919 and 1920. And here's a visual, again. The decline from 1926 to 1927 was actually just as sharp as the decline from 1920 to 1921. The Black Sox scandal was, the loss in the, during the Black Sox scandal was essentially replicated after the 1926 season. Going to pitching again, highlighting the disastrous decline in 1921. But notice by 1922, their pitching WAR is just about what it was in 1920. And of course, a lot of that is that huge Faber year that I talked about earlier. And by 1925 and 26, the pitching WAR was pretty much the same as what it was in 1920. And again, this is the visual here, to give you some visual view of what I'm talking about here. Well, what about team defense? The Sox were actually very good defensively throughout the 1920s. The 1921 to 28 teams, with all their problems, fielded about as well as the 1920 team did. With the exception of 1924, they were very good defensively. And notice, even in 1921, they are just as good defensively, as far as defensive efficiency goes, as the 1919-1920 team. And again, here's the visual that we're talking about here. Again, the steep decline in 1924, but you see 26 and 27 is very comparable to, and this is just ranking among the eight American League teams, very comparable. Well, myth of Comiskey is the tight one. For the years 1918 to 1926, in all but two of those years, the Sox player payroll was above league average. And the 2 years it wasn't was the lean years of 1923-24, when they didn't have much talent. Pictured here is Willie Cam, the third baseman I talked about, and the check that Comiskey wrote for $100,000 to the San Francisco team to get his services. The most paid for a minor league player at that time. Hall of Fame pitcher Chief Bender said, quote, "Willie Cam was the best third baseman I ever saw." Bleacher Report has him the 30th best third baseman of all time, ahead of Buck Weaver, by the way. He still holds the American League record, single season record for most putouts by a third baseman, 243. He led the team in fielding percentage, in league in fielding percentage 8 times, including 6 times in a row. He had a 27.1 White Sox career WAR, 14th highest among White Sox position players. Joe Jackson only had a 27.8 WAR for the White Sox. Weaver, 21.2. And Cam's peak WAR was actually higher than Weaver's also. Well, I told you that Kaminsky spent well but not wisely. Well, here's one of his not wises. Any, raise your hand if you know who Bill Sisel is. Okay, you have his autograph. You're the one. I don't even think the Sisel family has that, yeah. Well, his was the biggest purchase ever, according to some of the newspapers at the time. In 1927, he had a big Pacific Coast League season in 1926. It looked like the shortstop that would fill the hole the Sox had in shortstop at the time. He became, quote-unquote, baseball's costliest player. The Sox sent $75,000 to $100,000, sources vary, plus 2 players that were worth another $30,000 to $40,000 to Portland to get the services of Bill Sisel. What the Portland Beavers reaped was said to be the biggest compensation ever for a minor league player. Now, Sisel played in parts of my 9 seasons, very undistinguished seasons. Turned out he was average defensively, and he was adequate field and no hit. Well, in conclusion, despite the criticisms then and today, it appears that the Sox did a pretty solid job rebuilding the team, considering all the unfortunate circumstances. In the 4th year of the rebuild, the Sox were again a winning team. This rebuild is light years better than the 1914-15 A's did in their rebuild, and very comparable to the 2010-15 Astros rebuild. Despite the fact that the Sox were rebuilding under much more difficult circumstances than the Astros were. The Sox real decline started in 1927, and in part by the ill health of Kaminsky and the aging or retirement of Kaminsky's old buddies. He knew everybody in baseball, basically, and a lot of them would bird dog for him, you know. Yeah, scouts and everything. Well, they were getting old too, or retiring or dying. It wasn't just Kaminsky's ill health. But regarding his ill health, Kaminsky biographer Tim Hornbaker writes, quote, throughout 1920, Kaminsky suffered from increased health concerns, and it grew in severity to the point in which his doctors advised him to completely refrain from watching any games. Increasingly, he relied on his lawyer, Alfred Austrian, and team secretary Harry Grabner to essentially manage the team in his absence. While it is perhaps overstating things to say that the White Sox decline in the late 1920s was solely because of Kaminsky's ill health, it certainly played a part. One final point. The Sox lean years in 1927 to 35, perhaps the low point in the club's history, cannot be blamed on the Black Sox scandal alone. As by 1927, the 1920 Black Sox stars would not, given the normal aging process, have been stars anymore. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention today. Thank you. Should have time for a few questions here. 1 minute? Go ahead.
Yeah, so thanks, Bruce. That was great. I have looked into that stuff before, too, and I think you did a great job with the conclusions. The one thing that I am curious about is, like, do you have exactly any sense when Kaminsky wasn't involved with the building of the team? Because I think I think you've done a wonderful job of showing that, like, yes, the team was rebuilt, and that was the old man himself. That was the old Roman. And I did get the sense that the reason the team really collapsed is once he was no longer involved. I haven't been able, the best I could pinpoint is that you see him talk, you know, he's in the press talking about, like, Cam, he was very involved with getting Cam. And then there's just a point that you can tell it's no longer him talking. It's either Lou Comiskey or Harry Grabner. But I would
agree and only say that it's not just Comiskey, it's his whole network. The old Ted Sullivans and Tip O'Neills and all,
like,
that.
Lyons was maybe the last tip he got that, like, he was tipped off. Somebody, a friend of his in Texas, tipped him off. Hey, you want to look at this guy? And they got Ted Lyons. So, okay. But... Anyway, well, thank you. It was wonderful talk.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Is it possible you could show that check again, $100,000?
It's printed in Ritter's The Spirit, The Glory of Their Times. So take a look at that book. I took it straight off that book.
Okay, what I wanted to know was, when I was looking at it, I did not see any numerical representation of $100,000. Like you normally would see on a check now, you'd see the amount numerically, and then on the next line it would be in words.
Well, they cashed it, and that's important. No, that's a joke. The scan was such that you sort of blurred out some of the detail there. That's all I can say. But they did cash it. Wish I had $100,000.
I was just curious, would the 27 collapse have been mitigated at all if they kept Eddie Collins on as manager, do you think, or would it have happened anyway?
Well, according to Ozzie Guillen yesterday, it's the talent on the field that makes the good manager, not the... I think even Ozzie's hero, Tony La Russa, couldn't have turned around the 2017. Though arguably, you know, some would say that Tony La Russa was around in 1927, but I won't say that. Yes.
Yeah, Bruce, in 1925 and 26, Eddie Collins was the player manager. I actually thought he did pretty well. That winter, Landis does a big investigation of a game-fixing scandal in 1917 and 1919 involving the White Sox and the Detroit Tigers. Invites like 30 players, does this big investigation. Collins is a key figure in the investigation. That winter,
We're running out of time here, I think, so perhaps you could come in after. I'd be happy to talk afterwards. We're running out of time here.
Okay,
again, thank you very much.